This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time. This episode is one of three we did on location in Canberra with our partner, the ACT Writers Centre. You'll hear the sound quality is different to our normal smooth studio sound, but we promise it's totally worth it. Kate, this week we are talking about the book itself, its physical form, and we're going to start with covers.
Ooh, covers.
Yep, covers. Now, when you were writing Skylarking, I can remember talking about the one thing you did not want on the cover of your book. Do you remember what that one thing was?
Well, I do remember now. And I do remember quite clearly saying I did not want a lighthouse on the cover of Skylarking.
A and book of course, set at a lighthouse.
That is entirely true. That does have, might I say, the most beautiful cover.
It has a spectacular cover.
With a gorgeous lighthouse on it. But I was really surprised when I saw it for the first time. I didn't want a lighthouse. I didn't want
What was the lighthouse? Because the lighthouse is the setting of everything.
It totally is. I thought it was obvious. Like, you know, I don't know anything about book cover, book design. Like, that is not my world. But I just thought, oh, people won't buy a book with a lighthouse on the cover. And I was so deeply obsessed with the girls and, you know, and I thought, yeah, that it would have some other kind of cover. You know what I wanted? Natural Way of Things came out around the same time and Salt Creek by Lucy Treloar. And I loved both of those covers. Like, I can remember emailing Aviva to say, these are covers that I really love.
Unsolicited? You just offered?
I did. And she said, yeah, well, we can't do those because that would be entirely derivative. And that's a particular thing. And it was before I'd seen the cover.
There is a thing, Natural Way of Things is a book by Charlotte Wood for listeners, and we will load a photo of that cover on show notes. There is a thing about the floral cover, though, isn't there?
Yeah, and well, this was before all the floral covers, and also that really, beautifully kind of graphically designed thing that says this is the only book that looks like this, which, of course, it doesn't so much anymore. But it's hard, too. It's like weird names for babies or something. Like, you know, the cover actually ends up saying more about the book than anything else for the outside world. And you've been inside this book that has no physical representation for so long. And then suddenly you've got it and you've got to learn to love it. And you're going to be looking at it a hell of a lot and sharing a lot of pictures of it. I'm really glad that I've got the cover that I ended up with.
So you liked it straight away. It is a beautiful cover.
I was shocked by it, as I said, because I didn't know about the lighthouse and it was so completely unexpected. But then, yeah, like anything, you really grow to love it and I completely identify with the colours. It's the cover of the book. The title of my book and my last name posed a bit of a problem, graphic design wise or for the design, because they're both too long, so that I know it was a bit of an issue. And I remember the first time the kind of cover was up for a public audience was at a bookseller's conference, and it was up next to, I'll remember this forever, it was up next to Mark Smith's book. And I remember that the people from Black Ink just leaned over and said, we need the title to be bigger, because Skylarking just looks like so tinsy-wincy next to Mark's book.
And so Skylarking also has a different cover overseas.
It does.
And did you get any input into that?
No input at all for the UK design. And again, really different cover. It's very striking. It's kind of this grey colour cover with a big yellow moon, I always associate it with. And I think that what I know now is you just trust the designers in any particular market that they know exactly what they're doing and they know what they're going for. Sometimes when I go into schools, kids have bought the UK version because it must be cheaper to buy into Australia when they're studying it. And
that's so interesting.
Yeah, it's really funny. And so the kids kind of all hold them up. But by and large, the kids all like the Australian cover more. I don't know. Have you seen any other covers? Let's talk about your cover.
Yes. So there is an alternate. I suspect there was an original cover. Because if you Google it, an alternate cover comes up to the one that is now in the book.
Oh my gosh, I haven't done that.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, yeah. So it's I can't remember what color it is, but it's more the person with headphones on their head, and then the face is like the words, the helpline.
Yeah, right.
But it's so it's a bit busier. But they obviously didn't go with that cover. They went with the cover that the helpline currently has, which was developed quite late in the piece.
And so tell me about when you first saw that. What happened?
So Mandy sent an email probably only about 3 weeks before it went to print. So the book went to print in July. I probably saw the cover early June. I liked it straight away. I was happy. It felt inevitable, which I think is sort of, you know,
how it
should be.
That's
a good sign.
Exactly, yeah. How it should be. I remember you saying at some point that that your designer or the people at Text had said that the cover needs to tell a particular thing in your genre. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's a book. So the helpline is considered entertainment as a book. So it's not sort of sitting in the literary genre. I think they're calling it uplit now.
Ooh, uplit.
Uplifting literature, uplit.
Oh, I like it.
Very clever.
Very clever.
But it's a book that's about entertainment. So the idea is that the cover also has to be entertaining. So I think they had a lot of back and forth internally about making sure the cover was entertaining. But the nicest thing about the helpline, if you have a copy, is the texture.
Oh my gosh.
The cover.
There are feels. Actual real physical feels on the cover of Catherine's book.
Stroking my own cheek.
When did you get the first physical copy?
So the first physical copy, I was at the Dimmicks National Conference, and they actually had a trade fair. And while everyone was eating lunch, I went to try and find Shalini in the trade fair. Didn't find her, found the stall and saw the book sitting there. So it was a bit anticlimactic. It was just me alone with the book. So I took two copies and put them straight into my bag, and then really got home, gave one to my parents and one to my husband. Didn't really even touch it myself.
Because you felt weird about it?
Felt really weird about it. Just probably, you know, the only reason that I even took them was because I knew that they were dying to see it. I was probably less dying to see it. And then about 2 days later, a box arrived full of books. The kids were like, this box is here. You know, can we open the box?
And what did you say?
I said, no, we're not opening the box.
You are the meanest mum in the world.
I'm so mean. So I just pushed the box into the study and it probably stayed there for 3 weeks unopened.
Honestly, there are some aspects of you I just totally do not understand. So, unopened box, when do you finally crack the box?
Well, the only reason I cracked the box was we have an upcoming episode with Jane Rawson and Annabelle Smith.
It's true.
It's a really good episode. Probably one of my favourites,
yeah,
actually.
They're amazing.
They're really amazing. But as they were leaving, I was talking about the box and Jane completely, completely understood. So she had a similar experience and she said that once the book is out there, it's like everyone can see inside your head. And she, you know, spoke pretty eloquently about that, far more eloquently than I will now. But just that realisation made it a lot easier. And that was the day I opened the box.
I'm so very glad that you did.
But I haven't given anyone any books because, like, I've given to my husband. Oh, I've given to a couple of people. My husband, my parents, my in-laws.
I've got one, guys.
And you've got
one. I've got one.
But
I've touched it and held it against my chest.
I feel a bit goofy trying to give it away.
Nah, hold on to it. People have to buy it. Your friends can't just have it. They have to come and buy it. I do love the chat about covers, though, and it's great that we talked to Karen Biggers in this episode because she had very particular feels about her cover and her French cover and what they meant for her own Lighthouse book that she has. So that episode is coming up.
On with the show. Today I have the very great pleasure of welcoming Canberra author Karen Biggers to The First Time.
Karen is the author of three novels, the first of which, The Stranding, was published in 2009. Since then, her books have been translated into French, Italian, Norwegian, Slovenian, and Spanish. Karen's work has enjoyed great success in France, where it has sold more than 500,000 copies to date. Her third novel, The Lightkeeper's Wife, was on the French national bestseller list for more than 42 weeks, going as high as number 3. Okay, we're going to start by talking a little bit about the first time you were published. Your first novel, The Stranding, came out in 2009. Can you tell us how and why you started writing it?
Well, I'd always wanted to write since I was a child, and that was my thing, you know, what I'd do on weekends. I had two children, my son and daughter. So when my daughter was very small, we were at a stage where my husband's a really big-time ecologist at the ANU, and his career was sort of bigger than Ben-Hur. And I was at this stage where I was also working as a scientist, despite my veterinary background. And we just weren't going to manage having two scientists in one family. It's such a massive sort of career and such a massive empire that my husband had that we had to make some decisions about what I was going to do. And he said to me, well, look, you've always wanted to write. So how about, and I love this, how about you work part-time as a vet, look after the children and write a novel in your spare time? So in 2 years, I sort of got down to the idea and wrote the first draft of my first book.
Within a two-year period?
Yes, with all of that going on. However, what stimulated the writing of this book was, this is another funny story, my husband said, okay, well, my daughter was 5 months old, why don't you go down the coast to this gorgeous house overlooking the sea, take Nina with you, and when she go for a few days, and when she's sleeping, you can write. And of course, you know, a 5-month-old in a strange place only sleeps for 45 minutes a day.
Optimistic ideas to sleep.
And look, I'd been taking some notes about an idea of something I might write, and I was trying to sort of fiddle with that a bit, and it just didn't grab me. And as I was sitting in this amazing house at the end of a gravel road overlooking the sea, I could see something out on the water, and I thought, what is that? And I went to the window and I looked out and I realised it was the vapour spouts of some whales migrating along the coast. And I'd never seen whales before in that context. And I raced outside and I was standing on the cliffs above the water and their pectoral flippers were waving. And it was just like, wow, it was such an uplifting experience for me. I'm someone who really connects with the natural world. And so I guess from there, I went back inside and I thought, what if you were at your lowest point ever? And at that time with a small child, the worst thing I could think that would happen would be to lose a child to cot death. What would be the worst point, lowest point you could be at, and how you'd never get over something like that, but how could you even take that first step of healing? Like, what would you do? How would that begin? And could you start to find some small seed in nature that would help you to begin? You're overwhelmed with grief, but how would you begin? And so that's where the story of The Stranding began and Lex began. I sat down and I started writing from a male perspective. I don't know why. I like writing males. My husband's really good at guiding me into making sure my males are realistic. I started writing from the perspective of a radio presenter who'd lost a child and subsequently lost his marriage because of the terrible fallout of grief, and how he would begin to start life again. Without even meaning to, like running away to escape everything and then somehow clawing his way back into life. And that's where The Stranding came from.
Right. And so how did it go from being something sitting on your computer, presumably, to being a book on the shelf?
Yeah, well, that was quite a journey. I think first books are always a massive journey, aren't they? So my husband, as a scientist, had contacts with Penguin, and he said, will you have a look at my wife's book? So, you know, I got it as tidy as I could. Many drafts, like, you know, I would never send off a first draft to a publisher or anyone. Well, you have to send it to someone, but not to a publisher anyway. So I'd done many drafts, and he sent it off to Penguin, and it came back after about 10 weeks and they said, no, you have to like the characters, and just some sort of bland, non-specific comments. And so I put it in the bottom drawer and I started writing something else. I thought, oh, it's no good, it's terrible, I'm no good, but oh, look, I like writing, so I'll start something else. And after a few weeks of doing that, I thought, oh, is that really trying, you know, to give up that easily? So I thought, okay, I'm going to need to try and find an agent. So I did some homework, and which I think is really essential, and I looked up different agents, and I looked up how to write to agents and appeal to agents, and I spent a couple of weeks crafting a one-page cover letter. And then I reworked the start of, they only wanted, I don't know, 50 pages or something. So I reworked the first 50 pages as tight as I could possibly get it again and sent it off. And I think there's definitely an element of luck in these things. But, you know, the agents get 100 manuscripts a week across their desk. And so, you know, they read the cover letter in the first page. So it wants to really grab you. And I just had the good fortune. I sent it to Fiona Inglis at Curtis Brown. And my book was set in a country town. And she's from a country town, The Rock, in New South Wales, near Wagga. And she connected with the characters and she said, okay.
And what was that moment? Like, was that an email or a phone call?
It was an email, I think. And she said, all right, we need to meet. How good are you with a red pen? It's 150,000 words. It needs to be about 100. Can you start cutting? So Then I sat down and I looked at each scene and I said, is this scene essential? How does this progress the novel? And if it didn't progress the storyline or the journey of the characters, even if I loved that scene, it went. And I got it down to about 100,000 words. And then what's interesting is she then sent it off to four publishers over Easter. And within 10 days, we had offers from three, including Penguin.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, I guess, you know, agents are a screening process, really, aren't they? Because, like, so many people can send their work in, but the agents introduce your work. So having an agent who can champion your work and present it to somebody and say, this is a new, big, exciting thing, is, you know, a great step forward. And my agent's been very helpful and supportive to me over the years since that time.
And so did you, this is probably getting a little bit ahead, but did you sell Australia and New Zealand rights or did you sell the world rights at that
I'm trying to remember. I think it was Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah.
And I think we also gave, because I decided to go with Allen and Unwin.
Yeah.
Because I felt the publisher there was going to do the most to nurture my writing, even though it wasn't the highest offer that I got.
Yeah.
I chose to go with who I thought would help me as a writer to develop in the future, which I thought was important. I didn't just want to get books out there. I wanted to get to good books at the pace that they may or may not come. Sorry, what was the question?
Did so they had Australia and New Zealand rights and then...
And we gave them the world rights for 12 months and then they reverted to us.
Ah, okay.
That's how...
And how did you get a sense through that process of having multiple offers of who was going to be the right fit?
I went to meet each of them and they were all lovely. One of them, the one thing that put me off was they gave me a book and they said, can we have an ending more like this, which was a marriage proposal on the beach at sunset on horseback. And I thought, okay, that is not me.
Nice.
Yeah, so I kind of made the decision on the basis of, they were all really lovely and, you know, I'm sure I would have been well supported by each of them. But I knew that Jane Palfreyman at Allen and Unwin was going to push me hardest.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's had its ups and downs over time. She's always been great, but, you know, having it the way it is, told to you the way it is, can be challenging at times.
So she's your editor?
Yeah, she's my publisher. Yeah, my commissioning editor at Allen and Unwin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what have been the highlights of working with her?
Oh, the highlights with her is that, you know, she does push you really hard, and so she makes you go the next level, go deeper, go further to really find the core and the heart of the book. And, you know, sometimes that's been hard. Sometimes the last two books, the one that's now at copy edit and will come out early next year, I had to completely rewrite that book.
Right.
Yep. And so what I'd already written, which I knew was not right, it basically has laid the foundations for the new book. There was nothing that I took out directly and put
really?
In. I completely
but
rewrote
you,
it. It's much better.
Got to know the characters through
yeah.
the first process.
So none of it is wasted. You know, it's all part of the journey. And I went to a talk by Alex Miller just recently, and he was talking about the writing of novels and how he had the great gift of Coal Creek, which came to him in the space of, he wrote it in 10 weeks and it needed very little work. But he got up there and he said, you know, that's a once-in-a-lifetime gift. I've had it once. Not everyone will get that. Most people won't. And he said, whether it takes 10 weeks or 10 years, there is just the work that needs to be done. And I found that incredibly reassuring. And I thought, yeah, that's how it is for all of us.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so what sorts of things that very first time were you prepared for, and what things were you not really prepared for?
How do you prepare when you've really done nothing like that before? And that was 2008. There was very little information given to me, and I was coming straight out of being a vet and a scientist, so I didn't really know anything about the world, and I just imagined that the publisher picks you up and does all that needs to be done. But of course, you know, I know very differently now. So what I wasn't prepared for was the fact that I didn't actually have a publicist. The publicist left 2 weeks before my book came out, and so I got very few reviews and had no one to help shepherd the book into the world as such. You know, must have been some things going on at the publishing house at that time. And so I wasn't... Everyone with their first novel has great hopes and dreams of this being the one that goes kaboom and it's going to go crazy and sell like mad, and this is, you know, all hope that. That's what you dream about. And you're not... wouldn't be prepared for that anyway, but you hope that'll happen. But what you're not prepared for is, you know, mediocre sales. When it first comes out, because you're somebody new and less, and the world of debut novelists has changed a lot since 2008. Like, it's the really big thing. They're always looking for the new big thing and really getting behind debut novelists in a way that they perhaps weren't back then.
Right. So you think there's been a real shift?
I think there's definitely been a shift. Yep. Clear shift in that time. And it depends on who you get as your publicist and what you can do in the background. I mean, you can definitely help. But I think if your book is going to go bang, you really need a massive thrust from behind with your publisher.
So you think publishers are much more invested in first-time novelists now than they were historically?
I think they are. Yeah, I think so.
Right.
They're publishing more books too, more titles, more books.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a good and a bad thing. A bad thing in that there's less time for them to invest in each book, and it will depend on the publisher and how many publishing house and how many books they're producing. But it's a good thing because there's more names and more people getting exposure out there. But, you know, it's such a subjective, fickle industry, and the more years that pass and the more I'm associated with it, I think the less I know. Perhaps, yeah.
And so what was most challenging then about that?
Well, my first novel didn't sell particularly well. I didn't have many reviews. I had some good reviews, but I didn't have many reviews. And it didn't sell badly. I think in the end it sold about 7,000 or something like that. But it took time and you know, I wasn't the bestseller in the huge bestseller that everyone hopes that they've produced, so...
So if we flash forward from then to now, and looking particularly at the overseas experience, your work has enjoyed phenomenal success in France. Can you tell us how that came about?
Well, when I say, you know, it had nothing to do with me, of course it had something to do with me because I wrote the book, but it just came out of the blue, really. Some years after The Lightkeeper's Wife came out in 2011 in Australia, it did well in Australia. I think it sold about 25,000 in Australia, which is, you know, a bestseller. And then it was sold on Frankfurt Book Fair, sold on to a publisher in France who really liked the idea. And she was the head of a small publishing house that did few titles really well and really beautifully. But before The Lightkeeper's Wife came out over there, she moved to the mass market publishing of Livre de Poche, which are these beautiful small books that the French do that are sold quite cheaply and produced in great numbers. And she liked The Lightkeeper's Wife so much she bought it a second time.
Oh,
so
right.
The first production was just really beautiful, and it sold about 25,000 in France. And it was a very different cover to in Australia, different market, I guess. In Australia, there's a woman's face on the cover and a lighthouse. And in France, it's just the silhouette, a very non-gender specific silhouette of a lighthouse with a beautiful colours and a sort of a milky green sea. It's gorgeous. And they really got behind it. I had the good fortune that the book also appealed to this very characterful guy who owns a bookseller, who owns a store called La Griffe Noire, in the Black Claw, just on the edge of Paris. And he goes on TV France every week talking about books, and he said, you know, this is the book of the summer. And right. So when it came out a year later in the Livre de Poche, the Poche format, it sold 100,000 in 6 weeks. It's just like, wow. Where did that come from? And
So does that mean, so it came out 12 months later?
Yes, in the small format.
But so there was a demand, a pre-existing demand, or it was that small format is a more affordable option?
Yeah, a lot of people wait for that. You can buy it in railway stations. You know.
Yeah.
The French are really into books.
Yeah.
You know, when they go out to dinner, rather than take a bunch of flowers, they'll take a book.
Right.
And because these posh format books, they cost about $12.
Yeah.
If you buy a $12 book in Australia, they often look cheap, but they do them beautifully. And they sell really well over in France. And this publisher just got right behind it. She said she wrote personally to 600 booksellers in Paris and said, I love this book, it's going to go well. And so it did. And so, you know, as I said, it had nothing to do with me. And wow. I just sort of stumbled across the success accidentally and on the night of my daughter's 14th birthday, which is two years ago, to the day yesterday, and she had a party, and I was just thinking, oh God, get away from screaming 14-year-old girls. And I just opened my computer and somebody had hashtagged me into a tweet that said something about 100,000. It was all written in French, and I thought, oh, what? That doesn't make sense. That can't be true. And so when I translated it, it was like, yeah, already more than 100,000 copies sold in France and a small miracle and in the Figaro France newspaper. And it's like, what? That's not real.
It's amazing as well, the disconnect. The author yeah. is so disconnected from that, you know, that that's how you find out, via Twitter.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody told me. So then after that, I contacted the Livre de Poche publisher and sort of tried to find a way and said, oh, look, you know, I just want to say thank you, you know, appreciate it. It's amazing, you know, really wonderful you've got behind the book. And then, you know, then I went over in April last year to do some promotions for, so that time, The Stranding, my first novel, was coming out in the posh format, and The Grass Castle was coming out in the large format with the other publisher, and they get on very well because this publisher's worked in both publishing houses. So, yeah, completely random, it seems, but amazing, but I still feel like it can't be real. That, you know, more people have read my book than live in Canberra. It's like, are you serious? My books.
And so can, like, logistically, language-wise and things, can you do events in France? And do you do events in France?
Well, I did. I've only been once. And when we had this, I said, would you like me to come over? And I offered to pay to go over. And they said, no, we'll pay your airfare and we'll pay your accommodation in Paris for a week. And so we all decided to go, my husband and my two children. And knowing that I was going, this was October and we were going in April, I had done 6 years of French at school, but I immediately enrolled in Alliance Française to brush up my French because I thought it's just respectful to make an attempt to try and do the best I can in French. So initially I was very nervous about that and I wrote some things to read out and had my teacher at Alliance Française check. And then after partway through the first day, I thought, oh, look, it doesn't matter if I make terrible mistakes. I'll just do the best I can, have a go, and somebody can help me stumble through when I get stuck. And a couple of events, I did have a translator, and that was fun too. That was really great. I would have a go and then get stuck, and they would take it, and I'd explain in English, and they'd take over. And yeah, it was quite fun. By the end of 3 days, I lay on the bed shaking with exhaustion because it's so hard thinking in two languages and trying, you know, to be vaguely fluent when you really haven't done the language much for years.
And you're still learning French?
I had to have a break because what's interesting, might be interesting for writers, is that when I was really working hard at writing in English, I found the French just kept getting in the way. And I, you know, when you've got to try and find the right word and you're trying to push other words in your head in another language, I found that really difficult with my writing in English. Not that it was coming in French, but it was disrupting my ability to write in English. So I've had a break and I'm starting again next term.
And so your French, this big sort of following in France, do you think about that when you're writing now? Like, do they enter?
So the biggest question that I was immediately asking myself was, what is it about my work that the French like? You know, what do they connect with. And the French really love nature. They really love wild places. They really appreciate the environment because a lot of their environment is so modified. And the thought of going somewhere where you can be the only person on a beach, I mean, they can do that in some places too, but they really love nature. And my books are all centered around place, wild places in nature. And Australia is exotic to them, so that appeals as well. Also, the French really, they don't need a happy tied up ending like the one I described before. They like to grapple with the human condition and also to grapple with a philosophical question. The French are great philosophers, and I usually, in my work, I try to tackle human issues and also potentially environmental or ecological issues and hover above them and discuss them within the context of a human story. And the French do like that sort of thing. So I think that's what they connect with. And so I don't need to write anything other than what comes best to me, which is to write about my country, to write about the land that I feel great love and connection with, and wild places and how nature can help people, I guess.
Yeah.
And our amazing animals. And I've had the great fortune as a wildlife veterinarian to work with many different species of Australian native animals in their natural habitats, which is where I prefer to see them.
So in terms of writing career, I mean, there are people who write books and their goal is to write books full time. You come from a vet sort of background. Is that something, do you like doing both? Do you think that is what works best for you?
I think it's good for my brain.
Yeah.
And for my ability to talk to people and socialise. Being a vet is 90% talking to clients and communicating and understanding, and it also uses that diagnostic part of my brain, so it's quite different from my creative brain. So it keeps me alert and thinking, and it's good. It is hard to go away from the writing because I find, you know, having a break, I usually don't work weekends, write weekends because of family time. So, you know, I'm off Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then Monday can be really hard getting back into the writing. But I think that the veterinary work's good for my brain, and I like people too, so, and animals.
Thinking about writing being one thing, but being an author can be sort of another thing altogether. Some of our the people that we've interviewed so far have talked about that promotional side of writing, and some of them really love it and some of them don't like it so much. What's your take on it?
Well, I think it's essential. I think you have to be working behind the scenes and doing things under your own steam and creating your own events and reaching out to your readers or potential readers. I think it's essential whether you like it or not. And you grow to like it. You get better at it. I remember my first event I organised to go down to Marimbula because that was near where The Stranding was set. It was, and I thought, great, well, I'll talk to the bookseller down there and go and do an event. And it was a beautiful, sunny Saturday afternoon, and there was a little local market going on across the road, and three people came. And, you know, I'd prepared an hour talk, so I duly went through that. But, you know, that happens sometimes, and that's fine. I think you just have to take it as it comes. Sometimes it's a small intimate audience, and other times you get more people and might do a luncheon for 80 people. But the more you do it, the better you get at it. But I think it's essential also to prepare if you're going to give a public talk.
And so what sorts of things have gotten easier over time?
Well, doing public speaking has definitely become much easier, but writing hasn't. Writing has definitely got harder.
Do you think that's because you're more ambitious about
No, I expect more of myself. Yeah. I push myself. I'm that sort of person. It's not that I have to be, you know, the best in the world. We'd all like to be that, but I'll never be that. But I expect more of myself.
But more ambitious in terms of what you want to achieve. Not in a sales.
Yeah, more ambitious.
I've
set my bar higher for what the production of my work and the quality of my writing as well as the story. You know, it's to me, I think story is essential because that's what carries a reader through a book, and I see my work as a crossover between literature and commercial fiction. So I don't really fit in the commercial fiction category, but I don't really fit in the high literature category as well. So it's kind of a crossover as far as I see, which is probably a harder category to inhabit because you have part of one audience and potentially part of another. Sorry, I've lost my track.
No. Just talking about what things have gotten easier and have things gotten harder?
Yeah, the process of writing. I do love the process, but with this current book that I got stuck, and I'd never been stuck like that before. It was a form of writer's block I'd never thought of. I've never had troubles with an empty page, but I was stuck with knowing how to fix this book. I knew it wasn't right, but I didn't know how to fix it. And I tried putting out all my little scenes here and there and trying to see if I could shift them around, and I just couldn't get it to work, and I just didn't know why. And my publisher gave me a pretty harrowing talking to, and within the context of that meeting I was able to keep my wits with me enough, because you do have to be fairly thick-skinned, to pull out the pointers that she gave me and go home, lick my wounds, and then start to rebuild the book. So I think, it gets harder. I don't find that I have lots of ideas, but they're not all good ideas. And, it is hard. It's always hard work. And as the lovely Nigel Featherstone says, when you get to the end of one book, you know how to write that book, but you don't know how to write the next one. And you have to go right back to the beginning. And, so it doesn't get easier. But I still love it. Not always.
Yes.
I love it and I hate it and I love it.
So on the topic of licking wounds and maybe receiving criticism, do you remember your first review?
I remember my first bad review. And it was by a local, it was in the Canberra Times. I'm not sure if it went national or not. It was in the, might have, because it was in the Panorama magazine. And it said, you know, that the Lightkeeper's Wife was set in an amazing setting on Bruny Island that was very much like Wuthering Heights, but that's where the comparison ended, sort of something like that. I'm probably over-dramatising what she said. And I would really love to wave the sales figures to that reviewer now, because I was completely crushed at the time. And my mother-in-law said to me, "Oh, well, you put yourself out there. You've got to expect that sort of thing," which really didn't help either.
No, very unhelpful comment.
So my advice is, Goodreads wasn't around back then, but it is now. I would never read any review that had less than 3 stars, because you're just going to be wounded. And that obviously, if somebody's given you less than 3 stars, they really don't get what you were trying to do. Mm. And there are so many different readers out there, aren't there? So many different genres of books and different readers. You are not going to please everybody. And somebody, you know, some on some of those sites, people just mouth off.
That's true.
And it's unhelpful. Whereas at least a review, they usually say something constructive and positive within it, if it is somebody who does reviewing as a practice. So, yes.
And on the note of advice, as I am about to leap into the world of publishing for the first time, what advice would you give me or another first-time author?
So I would say, do be excited, because you have to celebrate these amazing achievements as they come by. If you wonder, it's wonderfully exciting to be, and a great privilege to be published, but don't have massive expectations. Like, we all do secretly harbour those hopes, and that's good. You're allowed to have those, but kind of just hold yourself there so that you're ready to catch yourself if it doesn't happen. Like, it happened to Kate Morton. She put her first novel out there and it went, you know, erupted in England. So, and she was completely unprepared for the success. But I think most of us are unprepared for not the failure, but the lack of that massive flight of success that we all hope for. It is a competitive world out there, so do as much as you can to support your book. Talk to bookshops, offer to do events for libraries, do whatever you can. And then once you've, because you'll only get a month usually in the big publishing houses, you get about a month of support from a publicist. You can come up with a plan that you can continue to have rolling over after that. But you know, pretty much on your own after that early period. So I think you kind of have to decide how long you're going to give that, whether it's 6 months to, because it takes a lot of energy and a lot of time. And then you need to let it go and focus on your next work, because once you've done the best you can, then I think you have your responsibility then for yourself is to start to build. You want to have a list of books eventually, and some are going to go better than others. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't support that book. You should give it everything you've got. But there comes a time when you need to transition on to doing your next work. And you can be distracted by Facebook and I'm keeping my profile up as much as you like. But ultimately, your job is to write books. So I think it's easy to be distracted, but you have to decide, control that distraction and get on with the next one.
That's very good advice. Thank you, Karen Biggers, for being on The First Time. Okay, Karen Biggers, our first time quick five. So for your first time, agented or unagented?
Agented.
Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Overseas territories or just Australia and New Zealand?
Overseas, but didn't sell. I mean, it wasn't sold overseas. Till later.
Festival invites or no festival invites?
No festival invites.
Do you know how many copies of The Stranding sold?
I think about 8,000.
And now, Karen Biggers, what is your favourite novel by a debut author?
You have to let me think. Well, if you asked me today, I would say that your book, Skylarking, Kate, was my favourite. It's one of my favourites for the year. I love lighthouses. I love lighthouses, and my husband does research has a field project going on down at Buttery National Park, and I've been out to the Cape St George Lighthouse, and I've been around all the gutters in the area where your novel's set, and I really loved the tension that pulled you right through that book. So my favourite debut author is Kate Mildenhall with Skylarking.
Kate is blushing.
Yeah, it was a really wonderful book.
Thank you.
It is. It's a beautiful
book. It's beautifully written.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Ady and Harry Morris. The First Time Podcast is created with the support of Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, and RMIT School of Media and Communication.